session number 6042, reel 12.
Yes, the very top officers had a whole shelf to themselves. What's a shelf? Well, in each room, there were two shelves. You were either on the top shelf or the bottom shelf, and they were just plain wooden planking, and that's what you went to sleep on. That was your living space and everything else. It was, there was far more space than we'd had in some of the Thailand shelves, which were made of bamboo in Thailand. We each had, on those shelves, the junior officers each had about 3 feet of space. 3 feet by 6 feet of space. But as we hadn't got many belongings, that was quite a simple solution. Because John Bowen and I, and one other officer who was rather sick, were the only ones who'd been in Thailand, we were quickly recruited to give very comprehensive reports and talks on our experiences in Thailand on building the Thailand-Burma Railway. And that occupied many weeks because of the fact that this rule about not having too many people congregating at any one time. I learned the game of bridge. As I said, by law we were not permitted to work. And from the people who'd been in the camp for 3 years, I learned what they'd been up to during those 3 years of their trials and vicissitudes. I became worried when they told me that by the midsummer the temperature would be 100 or 105 degrees, whilst in the winter it got to 40 below freezing. And I wondered about how we would face up to it, having thin blood, and they had had 3 years to accustom to it, and their weakest had died, as I said, in the winter of 42. But that was not to be, as it turned out. A lot of people by this time were optimistic about the outcome of the war. The Chinese sent news into the camp, which from secret radios they operated. By this stage, we did not have a radio. There was not a radio in the camp. But lots of news filtered in from the Chinese. There was in the camp by this time, who'd arrived around the same time as ourselves, an American colonel who was completely fluent in Chinese and Japanese, and two British soldiers and one American sailor used to smuggle in Chinese newspapers, and the Colonel Hoffman, who was an intelligence officer in the Philippines prior to his capture, he used to do a very full translation, and we were kept fairly well informed of what the Chinese knew about the war. The local Chinese were very oppressed by the Japanese, because Mukden had been occupied since 1931 by the Japanese army, and it was, in fact, the hub of their great, once great, Manchurian army, the Kwantung army. And Mukden had great arsenals and headquarters for that part. But, of course, the great Kwantung army, which had done war against China, had captured Manchuria for Japan and occupied also Korea for Japan. The Japanese, by the way, called Korea Chosen. They didn't call it Korea, Chosen. And that army had been denuded, terribly denuded, of all of its equipment, aircraft, tanks, men, trained men, whole divisions, to feed the other Japanese units fighting the Americans in the Pacific and the British in Burma. It was a shadow of its former self. I came down with dysentery and was admitted to the quite excellent, compared with my past life, camp hospital, although there was still this great shortage of medical supplies. And I came under the administration of two excellent American doctors who ran this hospital, and I found myself recovering from it. The disadvantage of me having it was that I lived on the upper shelf. And before you could be admitted to hospital, you've got to be fairly well advanced. And as you're quite loose with dysentery, one has the accident climbing up the ladder to the shelf. But people by this time had become used to the fact that people with dysentery couldn't control their movements very closely. Now, there were a lot of interesting people in this camp. It was interesting for me, apart from giving talks on Thailand-Burma railway, which the others didn't know about, but on the sea journeys to Japan, which they didn't necessarily know about. And the last time I saw Singapore stories, 1944, for instance. And it was interesting to hear their side of it, because they had been the senior commanders in Java, Singapore, Malaya, Hong Kong, Borneo, and Sumatra, the East Indies in general. So it was an interesting time. The rations had been very good in the camp prior to us getting there, but like the rest of the Japanese Empire, which was rather ramshackle and was running short of food, and we had, for strangely enough, we had no rice whatsoever there, because rice does not grow in Manchuria. It's a temperate, cold climate. They had ceased importing rice because of the shortage of shipping, but they did grow stuff called kaoliang, which is a form of barley or maize, wheat. It's a grain, a cereal grain. And so the soups were kaoliang soups. And once a day we had a little bun, a little bit of bread, unleavened bread, about 2 inches square. And in order to get equity in the sharing out of the food, each room, and there were 48 junior officers in a room, depending whether there were 6, 7, or 8 on a shelf, and 3 officers would go to the cookhouse and draw the rations, and then it would be issued out. And in order to ensure equity in the portions, a different 3 officers went every meal, and the officers serving out got the last portions. And there were many, many eyes watching like vultures to see that they hadn't left too much for themselves during the issue. Again, here we had an issue of Red Cross. It was one box between 4. One of those little boxes between 4. And we gave to one of our 4, who had been a professor in Singapore University before the war, and who I've seen quite often since on British television in latter years, as an expert on bats and things in Malaya and the East, Professor Tweedy. He was, in fact, a pilot officer in the Royal Air Force. And he got, included in his kit, he got some incredible fine measuring instruments, including some calipers and a micrometer. And because we knew he was so honest, we gave him the job of sharing out things like cheese, cutting it up into exact measurements so that we each had an appropriate portion. But that was all the Red Cross that was issued there. Summer came, the temperature rose, we got to this 100 degrees, and with the... Don't forget that Manchuria borders Siberia and Mongolia and the Gobi Desert. And when you get these hot winds, they bring myriads of sand fleas. And life, just as in Japan and in Thailand, life had been made unbearable by lice, bedbugs, fleas and whatnot, with the accent on bedbugs, mosquitoes in Manchuria, in Mukden, it became sand fleas. They were quite merciless. Your nights were made sleepless, because don't forget we weren't expending any energy during the day. We were forbidden to work. Your nights were made hideous by these wretched sand fleas biting you. And you were hot, and there was great relief from your heat, because you were from time to time permitted to use the bath. And as in that part of the world there is permafrost at 20 feet, the water in the camp came from that sort of a level, so the water was terribly cold, so you could have a very cold bath to relieve your, not all the time, but you could get the perspiration and stink off yourself during this very hot summer. The Japanese of the camp were not, by my previous experience, overbearing. And it was a very full staff, even a colonel there with several officers. The only trouble I got into in the camp was that I smoked a cigarette too far from an ashtray. The Japanese also have an obsession about smoking near ashtrays with water in them. It's quite natural, really, because their own country, up to that period, was built entirely of wood, was subject to earthquakes, and much of the damage and the burning out of their cities pre-war had been through earthquake damage, spilling over a fire and burning the house and the city down. That is where I got into trouble. But I was seen being marched off by the sentry, by a colonel in the British Army, and he and an American brigadier who spoke some Japanese, they followed me into the headquarters, and they asked me what the score was, and I told them, and the Japanese just let me off with a slap face, and that was the end of my troubles in Mukden. So we're at July, and there were all this speculation about the end of the war. The news was good. People had started taking wages on the next Red Cross issue. I'll let you have my next Red Cross issue in return for a bowl of soup today. And then the two famous rhymes that I remember most. The optimist said, home and alive in 45. And the pessimist's mark was, Golden Gate in 48. And you took your pick which group you wanted to be in. I personally, when I'd got dysentery, I was in the latter group, being very depressed and low. Golden Gate in 48, Golden Gate, San Francisco, of course, Golden Gate in 48. But once I got over that, and I'd heard some of this news coming in from the Chinese, I became one of the home and alive in 45 group. Then came the great news. From the Chinese outside came the news that Germany had capitulated and surrendered and that the war in Europe was over. This was, of course, we got this within a week of it happening, not long after our arrival in Mukden. And the Japanese were at first reluctant to admit it, but finally they said, but they also said, it doesn't matter that Deutsche, that's what they call Germany, Deutsche, that Germany has capitulated. We shall fight on forever, though the war last 1,000 years. We knew by this time that they hadn't got the means of fighting on for so long. Of course, those who witnessed a few of these sinkings knew that they were being battered to death by American, mostly American might. Then in July, the news from the factory came in, the Potsdam Declaration, which said unconditional surrender for Japan. And shortly after the Potsdam Declaration, Russia, duplicitous as ever, broke its treaty with Japan and invaded Manchuria from Siberia. And this mighty Russian army, most of the units fresh from the conquest of Czechoslovakia and Berlin, because we talked to some of them, and they said where they'd fought against the Germans. It had, in fact, only taken the Russians that period to get all their armies from Europe to the Far East, and they swept through Japan. On the 16th of August, on the 15th of August, rather, the Japanese did not allow any of the factory workers to go to work, and they didn't say why. The Chinese the previous day had said that a new bomb had been dropped in Japan, but they didn't know anything else about it. On the afternoon of the 16th of August, many of us saw some parachutes coming down, having left a four-engine bomber of a type we'd never seen before. On the night of the 16th, late night, there was a great confusion in the camp. The Japanese vigilance had dropped. There were just the odd guard, and they didn't seem to care what you did. But we were in the dark. And about midnight in camp, some American cooks who were preparing the next morning's food, they came into the sleeping quarters of the camp and said, some American soldiers have just walked in through the guardroom, through the camp gates, fully uniformed, carrying arms, and the Japanese, they didn't salute the Japanese sentry, which of course would have been fatal for a prisoner of war to fail to do. About an hour later, we are now up to midnight, the camp lights came on, and a message was sent down from the Japanese that some American servicemen were negotiating our release. The next day, Major Hennessy and another major and a corporal and a sergeant of the American Army and two corporals of the American Army, who in fact were Japanese Americans, they brought them along as interpreters. They had previously been serving with American forces in Southwest Pacific as interpreters and interrogators. They came amongst us and said, the war's over, we've just got to wait to arrange your liberation, but you can't leave this camp. The Japanese are surrounding us, but the Russians aren't very far away. We can tell you that. And the Japanese don't believe the Russians are so close. Came the 20th of August, we were just stewing in the camp. And around this time, fighting broke out in the city. Not fighting between various factions. Various Chinese groups started firing on Japanese troops. Chinese nationalists, that's the Chiang Kai-shek faction, started firing on Chinese communists. And some of the bullets were whizzing over the camp. So those people who were sleeping upstairs on the second story moved down and slept on the parade ground. But the fleas, I was one of them, because I slept upstairs. But the fleas were so venomous, sleeping down on the parade ground, that it was worth sleeping upstairs to get away from the fleas on the sand of the parade ground. True to form, in the late afternoon of the 20th, Russian tank, Russian trucks rolled up to the gates of the camp, which were open, because the Americans, OSS, it was an OSS team that had contacted us, but not liberated us. And a captain named Getman, he came into the camp and he had a large squad of Russian soldiers with him, Tommy gunned and all the rest of it, including some women soldiers. And he had all the Japanese guards taken prisoner, disarmed, handed them over to the British and the Americans and the Dutch. Guards were immediately formed of the prisoners, and the Russians then put on a concert party on the back of their trucks, balalaikas, hot-stepping and the lot of it. And then they left. They didn't leave anyone in the camp, any Russians in the camp at all. And this Captain Getman said he would send a captain every day to see what they could do to help. The captain turned out to be a woman captain, actually. There were speeches by Air Vice Marshal Maltby for the British, Brigadier Callaghan for the Australians, Major General Parker, who became the senior officer in the camp, Dutch Major General, I can't remember his name, perhaps Ter Poorten, you know, saying everyone was bloody good people and nice show and the war's over and so soon we'll be home. Now, the first effect it had on me, well, I was delighted. But because my name begins with A, and so he's at the head of any alphabetical list, the next morning I found myself detailed with an American Marine captain as officers of the guard. And whilst a lot of the prisoners, having been liberated by the Russians on the 21st of August, a lot of the prisoners could go out of camp and just start mooching about anywhere they wanted to, this American Marine captain and I were officers of the guard. We had a guard of 24, mixed British, Dutch, Australian, American soldiers, and we occupied what had been the Japanese guardhouse. And in the guardhouse were the Japanese non-commissioned prisoners. The officer prisoners, the Russians had put in the offices, and there was a little guard over them as well. You will be surprised to know, I think, Conrad, that although many of these Japanese had beaten up many of the prisoners in the camp in the past 3 years, there was no, not only was it not allowed, but there was no desire to go and wreak retribution on them. One particularly unpleasant guard, who had been nicknamed Eleanor, after Eleanor Roosevelt, and I asked an American why, and he said because Eleanor is so ugly, he resembles Eleanor Roosevelt. He had been in a detached camp that they had there, and some Chinese brought his head into camp. So that was the end of the unfortunate, unpleasant, nasty Japanese guard nicknamed Eleanor. They brought his head in a bucket into camp. But on the 22nd of August, I went out into Mukden, having done my 24-hour guard duty, and I didn't catch it again because there were so many officers in the camp that you'd have to be there for months to catch the guard duty again. I'm not going to tell you any details about this because what you asked me initially when I started these tapes was you wanted the experiences in the war, and we're now on experiences in the peace. I don't know, would you answer? Do you want to know what happened now, other than in very brief form?
Well, if you can give me a brief rundown.
Right. Well, the Russians permitted 3 American Liberators, B-24s, to fly into the local airfield. Because the Japanese had a lot of very fine airfields around Mukden, which was their headquarters for Manchuria. And these B-24s took out the very top generals and the governors of the islands, like the governor of Singapore, the governor of Hong Kong, the governor of the East Indies, the governor of Guam. And they took them out and they took their aide-de-camp with them. They took out a few of the other senior officers to fill up the plane. They took out the very sick prisoners, whatever their rank, people who needed good medical attention quickly. So 3 liberators did that, and they flew them from Mukden to Kunming in China. And then from Kunming, of course, the Americans were then flown eastwards to Honolulu, Saipan, and America, and the British were flown Kunming, Chungking, India, and home. And by the way, most of the British landed 3 miles from where I'm sitting in Poole Harbour from a flying boat. General Percival, GOC Singapore, Major General Maltby, they landed in Poole Harbour just 3 miles behind me where I'm sitting now. Now that left the rest of us in the camp. Now, the Americans had said to the Russians that we will send in a fleet of Dakotas and Liberators and fly all the prisoners out. And the Russians tentatively agreed. And then they withdrew permission. They said the airfield wasn't strong enough to take them. Of course, that was a lie because this had taken them before. And they were only going to come in and do a one-off anyway. So that was abandoned. And the Americans then switched those aeroplanes to flying Chinese Chiang Kai-shek soldiers to occupy parts of North China. And the history will tell you that the Russians hoped to keep Manchuria for themselves, but they reckoned without Chairman Mao. So we just sweated it out. We used to go out into Mukden. We had a plethora of food because the Americans flew every day 3 super fortresses, B-29s, flew all the way from Saipan, over 2,000 miles, and showered us with supplies. With the liberation of Japan and Korea and Hong Kong and everywhere else, with the end of the war, the Americans and the British, not being prepared for the end of the war so suddenly, they'd run out of parachutes for supply dropping. So all the supplies we had dropped on us at Mukden were free dropped. The B-29s had a big wooden crate built over the bomb bay doors, and they pile up supplies on them, sometimes in 40-gallon drums, but other times loose, and they'd tie a rope on one end of the... They used to come solo, you could see all this happening. They'd tie a rope on one end of it, and at a given moment, a man in the plane would pull this rope and pull a little peg out that supported this huge crate, because a B-29 is a gigantic bomber. And then not only the crate, but all the supplies would come flying down to earth. Boots, shirts, cigarettes, cocoa, tin fruit, you name it, it was there. And the Americans who'd come in on the 17th, 16th, 17th, they had been followed in by the colonel commanding the OSS, Colonel Donovan. He'd come in on one of the B-24s that took out the top generals, and he'd brought in a large supply of US dollars. And he sent prisoners, liberated prisoners, out on purchasing trips into the city of Mukden and the surrounds. So we had all the eggs you could eat, and we had so much food dropped on us by American Air Force that the doctors in the camp got together with the top officers in the camp and put an actual rationing scheme in force, because the doctors were worried that people would actually eat themselves to death. Their stomachs, their systems weren't attuned to eating high quality, rich food. And a lot of people were very ill through overeating. I know I only overdid it once. I ate 6 eggs in one day. Fried them. We found all sorts of pots and pans to fry in. And I felt ill from eating 6 eggs, but I learnt my lesson. The only thing I craved for that I couldn't get from airdrops, I've always liked Nestle's condensed milk. And on my first day out of camp, I took some Japanese clothing with me in my hand, and I went into the city market area, because Mukden has a very old city, more than 2,000 years old, the inner city, and they have street markets. And I sold these Japanese garments for 200 yuan. And with the 200 yuan, I bought one tin of Japanese army condensed milk.